Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, all the chips and the PC. It is Saturday, the 5th day of June. My, Anno Domini 2021. And you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 7 minutes after the hour. We're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues. Here comes the news. If you're on the phone already, we will get to you shortly. If you're not on the phone, why not? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Google will let Android mobile software users opt out of being tracked by advertisers on their smartphone applications following an earlier move by Apple to bolster privacy on iPhones. The option will become available in late 2021 with a Google Play services update. Developers will no longer be able to see a user's unique advertising ID if that person has declined to receive personalized ads. Unlike Apple's features, users won't be opted out of ad tracking by default. You'll have to do it by yourself. For months, Google has been mulling a way to give Android users more control over ad tracking with a less stringent approach than Apple's. In May, Google said it would create a safety section in its Play Store in 2022 so Android users can see what data developers collect about them and share, plus give access to additional privacy and security information. Apple roiled the mobile advertising industry in April when it debuted its app tracking transparency feature, which requires users to opt in to being tracked by apps for personalized advertising. Developers expect to lose revenue from the change because most consumers likely won't agree to have their data collected. You think? Google said the Play services rollout will affect apps running on Android 12 devices starting in late 2021 and migrate to other devices with Google Play in early 2022. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is soon you can opt out of Android tracking. And your choices are about stinking time. Meh, let them look. Is that good? Huh, Android. And, of course, other. So far we have 20 votes. 17 of you have said about stinking time. And I'm shocked at the other three. But of course, I'm sure you'll have more to say. So, if you selected other, or if you just want to talk about this, go to our home, page, our website at soundbites.org. That's bites with a Y. Francis would like us to remind you. Scroll down on the right under fascinating stuff. You'll see the forums. The second forum down is the poll discussion. Currently, at least the number one item under poll discussion is 5 June 2021. Soon you can I'm going to say it that way forever.
Yeah.
Soon you can opt out of Android tracking. Right now, nobody but me has posted, but my assumption is that there will be people who have plenty to say about this.
Oh, I'm still sick and tired of YouTube now. They've gone really wonky and throwing not just one ad in the middle of if you're watching something, say, somebody did a podcast, you know, or a quick YouTube video. Normally, they'd put one in the middle of it.
Right.
Now, it's like, no, that's not good enough. They wait and get into it for a minute, then do one, go a few more minutes, and then plop in another one.
Yep.
And they just keep shoving more in there, and it's like, nope, the minute it hits the ad, I'm away from it. Nope, sorry, you lost me.
And I've also read that they've lowered the rates they're paying for the ads that they put in. So the odds of becoming a YouTube paid celebrity are getting lower and lower.
Lower and lower. That's why so many of them are doing Patreon now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a program called Sponsor Block Pop-Up. Sponsor Block Pop-Up. And what it is it's a crowdsourced ad blocker. So what happens is if you're the first person to see a video, you'll see the ad.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do is go in and say the ad starts at this point and ends at this point. And when enough people do that, the ad gets skipped.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Sponsor Block Pop-Up. I've been using it for a while now. I don't see ads, unless I'm the first one to see, you know, early.
Yeah.
Early. I don't see ads anymore. It's great.
Sponsors.
The trick is that for podcasts that you really like, you should let the ads play because that's how they're staying on the air.
Well, that's this is for YouTube.
YouTube, I said podcast. Yeah, a lot of podcasters are on YouTube too, like us. But what we're also starting to see is a lot of the YouTube people are reading ads themselves in the show.
Right.
Which is a little harder to skip, but then you know they're getting paid. It's not a YouTube ad that YouTube gets money for. You want money to go to the person you're watching.
Right. If it's something I really like, I definitely watch the ads. That's not a problem for me. But so many of the ads are irrelevant to me. Like, honestly, I could not conceivably care less about NordVPN. And they are everywhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems like the same, you know, half a dozen companies are sponsoring every single YouTube channel and podcast.
Right. Right.
Like I said, if it's somebody that wanted me to watch their YouTube video, the minute it hits that ad, nope, gone.
Yeah.
I don't want to be force-fed other people's junk.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. All right, to the phones. Our first caller is Ed from Ithaca, New York. Hi, Ed. What's up?
Good morning, guys. Happy summer.
Happy summer to you.
I have an older Dell laptop running Windows 10, upgraded from Windows 7. It's an i3 processor, so it's obviously older. It is running out of memory space. I don't know if it's 4 or 6 gigs, but I have a notification that comes up saying delete previous version of Window, and I wasn't sure if that's safe to do or not.
Yes. Here's the thing. It's when you say it's running out of memory, it has nothing to do with your actual memory. That's the stuff on the hard drive. That's your hard drive space.
Uh-huh.
If it's telling you to delete previous versions of Windows, that's your hard drive space. The only reason you need to keep older versions of Windows on your machine is if you're going to go back to one of those versions at some point.
Okay, which I'm not.
Which you're not.
Okay.
So you can certainly delete Windows 7.
Right. Okay.
Cackle evilly while you do it, by the way. It makes you feel bad. Trust me. But if you have old versions of Windows 10 still on your machine, you know, backups for when it upgraded that, you can get rid of those as well, unless you're going to go back to one.
And there's also Windows will often save updates, so you can uninstall an update.
Right.
And that can take up a lot of disk space. There is a disk cleanup utility in Windows that will go through and find all that stuff and remove it for you. How do you know how big your hard drive is on all of this?
Because I think it's 256.
That's awful big. Small. Well, it's awful big to be running out of space already, unless you have a ton of pictures.
Yeah. No,
there's a program called TreeSize that will scan all of the folders on your hard drive and show you where the space is being used.
Uh-huh.
And it could be that it is the Windows updates that can be deleted. There might be cache files or temp files that can be deleted. So that will tell you what's taking up all of the space on your computer.
Okay.
For the Mac, there's one called Omni Disk Sweeper that sweeps your drive. So tree size for Windows. It can tell you all the folder sizes in your directory tree.
Okay.
That, no one knows what that word is anymore.
Right, exactly right.
Is there a way to find out something that will show all the processes that are running?
The process viewer will do that. There's a tab that says all versus just my processes. One of the problems there is that most of the processes have such cryptic names, there's no way to know what they are. So if there's one you don't recognize, Google it, and it will tell you what it is.
But again, it is most likely that your problem is disk space, not memory space. And the process manager will only show you what's in memory.
Okay.
What's actually running.
Okay.
Before we move on.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to say that, now I've completely forgot what I want to say. Oh, yes. When you go to erase that stuff, use the program that error message points you to rather than going in and randomly just erasing stuff.
Oh, okay. I use Revo Uninstaller.
That I don't believe that does old versions of Windows, does it?
I didn't see it on there.
No, no. I don't think so.
So when that message comes up, follow the bouncing prompts and do it that way.
Okay.
Rather than just randomly going in and erasing stuff, because that's not probably not a good idea.
Right. That's the other thing I wanted to ask about, because there are some apps that people install have found that I don't know what they are, and I don't know if I want them or not. One is called Nero 12.
Nero is a...
Nero
is a CD burning software. So if you make CDs, you want Nero.
Okay. What about Bonjour?
That is a zero config protocol so that your computer can automatically find file servers and printers on your network.
Okay, so I want to keep that. Do I need to keep Paint 3D?
Only if you want to do 3D painting.
Okay, same with...
I'm sorry, but...
Yeah. It sounds like these are all programs that came bundled with your computer.
Yes, yes.
And those companies paid your computer vendor a little bit of money to be included.
Uh-huh. All right, so I can get rid of Sketchbook and even mail and calendar and photos because I don't use it for that.
Yeah, if you don't want any of those programs, you can get rid of them. But first, get rid of those old versions of Windows. You may be surprised at how much space you have left.
Programs generally don't take up very much space.
Right.
Okay. Right.
Also, check your temp folder.
Yeah, I've run CC Cleaner, which I think is supposed to clear out the temp folder.
It's supposed to, yes. But it certainly doesn't hurt to check.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate all your help.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
And by the way, for Linux people, there's a disk usage analyzer called Baobab, like the tree.
Yeah. Isn't Unix, doesn't it just have a command called tree, which shows you all of the...
Well, it shows you all of them, but this is a graphical, sexy...
You type tree picture. And it just goes shooting by.
Yeah, exactly.
For the folks that are into the GUI.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's... I think it's pronounced Baobab. It might not be, and I don't actually care.
But be honest with you, more folks, you know, if you didn't have the GUI and just did it like the old way, the old school way,
yep,
it just a, you know, monochrome screen, you know, and just some lines, and it's like, what's this? Huh? How am I supposed to figure this out?
I've had a couple of very old, very slow little laptops over the years that I just run the command line.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can write Python programs for them, and I can run all kinds of stuff, and there's email. There's all kinds of programs that run on the command line that you don't need a graphical user interface for.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned all those commands long before there were any decent GUIs, so... I don't. I still remember them, and I still use them. But yeah, if you are a Windows user, you also have all of those command line programs available to you. In fact, if you're a Mac user,
yep.
I know this is sacrilege, but in fact, you have many command.
Tony loved. Oh my God, this command. This is Bash.
Right. He brought in a brand new computer. And he was showing us the greatest and latest at the time, Mac OS. And Tony Flacilla just pushed him out of the way and went to the command line and started looking around. You were really not happy.
That's in there.
Yeah,
actually had customers that it was a corporate mandate that they couldn't buy a Mac.
Oh, yeah.
But it was the graphics department, and they wanted to run Photoshop and InDesign.
Duh.
And so we sold them a Unix workstation.
There you go.
Because it's BSD Unix with the Darwin GUI on top.
Right.
No, Darwin Darwin's the kernel. Aqua was the GUI.
Right.
Again, the folks have to have the GUI. You try to get them down into what I call the basement and the guts of it, and like, you know, Tony, you know, going into the bash and doing it stuff that way, doing pseudocode and everything else. It's like,
well, those of us that grew up on
what are you doing?
Yeah, those of us that grew up on DOS, and before there was a DOS. Yeah.
Right, CPM.
And before that, I was learning Apple II command line. And that's how we did computers. That's all you had was typing commands.
That's exactly right.
They've made it, with the PyStar. I just had to update both my Py3s because they came out with a new version of PyStar. So a lot of it, though, once you get it loaded, that's the easy part. But then you got to do some updates to databases.
Right.
And there's like four different databases. So they have it built into the program where you, they've got a little utility that you go to the, into SSH and, you know, do every, all the command lines, you know, the RPI-RW to get in and everything else. But they've even made it easier that, you know, say somebody's typed out all the commands that you need to execute to update this database. Well, they've made it so simple now. You just go over, highlight.
Copy and paste.
Copy. Go over to the SSH window, right-click on it, yeah, and say paste. It opens up a little window.
Control-Shift-V ought to do it as well.
Yeah, and you just put it in there and, you know, hit enter. Boom, 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 boom. But, you know, I've gotten, I never thought I would get into pseudocode. And, you know, the bash shell in that is like, whoa.
I no longer own a computer that doesn't have a terminal window open. Both my Raspberry Pis do. All my Linux machines do. I have one open here on my Chromebook. The other Chromebook doesn't because that one is slow and running both the GUI and the Linux kernel. It doesn't have a lot of RAM and it doesn't have a lot of speed, so it's my older one, and so I don't do that much. But I've got a window open here to run the. I have a 30-second countdown program and a 60-second countdown program, and both written in Python and a Python graphical program that shows me how many people have voted. 22 so far. Get out there and vote, people! Vote on that poll.
Oh, one thing I did just a couple days ago. One of the foster kids that I transport. He's into computers and all that. And I go, you know, I'll just make up a name. Say Dominic, as say his real name. But, you know, he's saying, yeah, Mr. Dave, my computer finally blew up. He says, I really don't have a lot of money to go get another one. I go, you like to play around with them, right? Says, yeah, yeah. So I showed him one of the YouTube videos on a Raspberry Pi while we're waiting for him to go in for his visit. He goes, so how much are these? I said, you can get a whole thing for about $100. If you're running into questions, you can call me and I'll walk you through. Oh, I got to look this up. He says, that's a lot cheaper than going out and buy another computer and still get on there and do my stuff and that. Yeah. And now, matter of fact, they just came out with another unit that they can put on top of the Pi 4 for power supply.
Yep.
And it'll get it, draw it off the USB.
Yep.
So, you know, more and more things keep coming. But, yeah, I think I just opened up Pandora's box for this kid. As I, you see it on the video how easy it was to set up the operating system and, you know, just get it up, get it running. And if you mess it up, oh, no big deal, just refresh it. This could be a lot of fun. That'd be a great summer project. Get me back up. Well, there you go. If you need any help, let me know.
And if you do a Raspberry Pi 4, it's like buying an inexpensive laptop. It's going to be a little bit slow, but not noticeably so.
But he had just bought a few months ago, for his birthday, was a new 21-inch monitor.
There you go.
So the monitor is still good. I said, no problem. The Pi will plug into that.
Yep.
And your speakers and all that stuff, your keyboard, you can plug it all in. Oh, this is going to be... He was like a cat on a hot tin roof. Couldn't wait to get to it.
Yep. I also found a site that shows the Pi 4 with 8 gig has a higher-end power manager chip on it. And so you can take that 1.8 gigahertz processor and run it up to 2.3 gigahertz without a lot of problem.
Overclocking your Pi.
Overclocking your Pi.
Oh, yeah, they do that all the time.
Yep. It really doesn't work well with the 4 gig model or any of the 3s, but with the 8 gig 4, like I said, it's got that higher-end power chip on the board.
Yeah, and that's easy to get into because all you got to do is, you know, when it first starts up, is hit the... Was it the escape key? And that brings up that menu because you got to change the screen size and then you can
For him, yes. Yeah. What I'm talking about is just you change a couple of things in the config file and it's done.
Well, you can on the boot up. You can now. There's a
yes, but if you want it permanent,
yeah, no. You hit the escape. There's a whole menu.
Okay.
You can do the overclocking. You can change the screen size and how much memory it'll use.
Yeah,
because by default, it wants to only use 3 gigs. So if you got a 4 gig or 8 gig model, you can make it permanent in there. So yeah. Once it keeps booting, it will do that.
Yep. Okay. To the phones. Our next caller is Steve from Greece, New York. Hi, Steve. What's up?
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I have a Linksys EA9300, and I bought a Linksys RE7000 range extender, and I've had the Wi-Fi about 5 years and the extender for 3 years.
Uh-huh.
This is my 4th year. I've always used the WPS button to link them.
Sure.
And this year, the WPS button doesn't work. And I want to get back out to the backyard with Wi-Fi, and I don't. There's got to be another way to link those that I cannot find.
A lot. Many routers now have disabled WPS because there's a weakness in it, and it's a stupid design flaw. WPS uses an 8-digit key, which sounds like enough, right? But no, it actually uses 2 4-digit keys.
Right.
So it tries a 4-digit key, and then it tries another 4-digit key, but the last digit is a checksum, so it's really only a 4-digit and a 3-digit. So instead of being 100 million combinations, it's 10,000 combinations and then 1,000 combinations. So it's really easy to bypass.
Right.
So there's a huge security flaw in WPS. So a lot of places have stopped doing that. So usually then you have to go through manual setup on your device in order to have it join the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I've been into my thing. I went into my router settings and things like that, and it's sort of sees the extender, but I can't make it hook up.
In Wi-Fi, once you have authenticated, okay, in the browser section of your router, right?
Right.
Okay. Once you've logged into it, under the wireless section, do you still see a choice of Wi-Fi protected setup?
I believe so.
If so, check the client device, the extender, and see if there's a WPS, which is Wi-Fi protected setup, a WPS PIN number. If that's there, you can then type that in on the browser thing and hit register.
What brand was the extender?
Well, other than my Linksys. I specifically bought Linksys so they'd match.
Okay.
All right, listen, we got to take a break. Hold on. Stay on the line, Steve. We'll get back to you back in just a couple of minutes. Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco. 29 minutes after the hour. Sound bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 36 minutes after the hour, we are sound bites. And we still have Steve from Greece, New York, on the line. Steve, you still there?
I am still here. You can't get rid of me that easy.
Dang it.
We tried.
Yeah.
So where did we leave off? I'm sorry.
We were talking about PIN browser reset or something.
Yeah, in your main router settings.
Yeah, which I have up now.
There may be an option to add a device by its WPS PIN instead of having the device
try to find it.
Push its PIN to the network and the router find it.
Okay. That be Linksys home networking?
Somewhere under add a device.
No, what you can do is in the system under wireless. Where was it? Hold on, I'll find it. There it is. Under the wireless settings.
Yeah.
Under basic wireless settings, you should see two choices: manual and Wi-Fi protected setup.
So wireless.
Wireless, basic wireless settings. It should be right. So across the top, you have setup and wireless and security and storage.
No.
No.
Across the top is wireless, MAC filtering, Wi-Fi protection.
Click on wireless.
Pardon?
Click on wireless.
Yeah.
And now do you see on the right, in the gray area, Wi-Fi protected setup?
Yes.
Okay, click on that.
Yeah.
Now, theoretically, there are two choices, manual and Wi-Fi protected setup. Trademark.
It probably is by the Wi-Fi Alliance.
That'll be over in the white section again, near the top.
Okay.
Are you there?
I'm here. Wi-Fi view and change router settings. I do have a router PIN number. I did see that.
You're looking for this section to add a new device by WPS.
Right. Under Wi-Fi protected setup.
Right. There is a push button, the Wi-Fi protected setup button.
Right. When you press that, what happens?
When I press that, it says, please wait. So I do.
And then you have to press it on the other device, too, so they can talk to each other.
No, you're looking at a physical button now, right?
I actually just pushed it on the screen.
Okay.
Yeah, so that tells your router to be looking for a device. Now, physically go to the other device and push the button on that device.
Which I have done.
And they should be able to talk to each other.
And I may throw, okay, it's still going around and around like crazy. I'm going to throw a curveball at you. In my notes for my router and Linksys and all that other stuff, I do see a note for Linksys Smart Wi-Fi sign-in. Does that change things any?
It shouldn't.
Yeah,
if you're logged into the router as the administrator, you're above all that.
You've got all the rights.
And I think that's the Linksys end to manage your network and devices, not the local end.
And I'm getting what I always get. I just get the please wait in the circling.
Yeah.
There's
supposed to be another section near that pin where you can type in the other device's pin, and it will just use that instead of looking for it.
Okay. It does. There is a box. If your client device has a Wi-Fi protected pin number, enter that number here and then click register.
That's what I was saying, yeah.
So is that where I click in the 8-digit number?
From the extender, yes.
The extender has a PIN number for it.
Pardon?
The extender has a PIN number for it.
Will that be on the back or something?
Probably.
All right. Well, you guys are going to fix this. I know you are.
Well, we've got other people waiting on the line, and you just need to fill the PIN number in to that field and click register, and they should connect.
Yep. All right. Thanks.
Give us a call back. Give us a call back once you try that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And I've posted a couple of links from the Linksys' webpage on how to help, too. They have a website, extender.linksys.com, that tries to talk you through it by joining the Wi-Fi network of the extender first, because it creates its own network. And then you log into the browser on it and then tell it what your main browser is, or your main router is, so that it can talk to that. So it's we have to be our own network administrators and network managers now because of everything.
Yep.
We don't have companies behind us anymore. We're all doing this at home.
Well, that's the thing. They try to make it so everybody can go in and set it up. You know, before it was, you had to be a network specialist. Now, for the most part, folks can go in and set up their own home network relatively easy. They've made the menus.
Relatively.
Yeah, that's why I say relatively. I won't say that, you know, it's a cakewalk, but you got to, key thing again is read and take your time.
Yep.
The problem is, and I hate to say this,
people don't do either.
Today's society wants everything spoon-fed to them or done for them. They don't want to take the time to read and learn. And I see this in setting up a lot of programs. Instead of taking the time and doing the research and learning how to do it, so in the future they could do it again if something, and if it's electronics, you know it's going to fail. You know, so why not learn up front how to fix it and keep it up and running?
Right. I tell people, I have told people for decades, the thing that makes me a PC guru is I read the documentation. That's really what
it
takes.
And actually doing it, you know, and
right.
reading and doing that and then going in and applying it. By doing both, now that's what gives us the advantage when people call in and do it, because we've read and we've done it.
Right. Sometimes it's frustrating when, well, it's always frustrating. People will say, I've been searching for hours and I can't find the answer. I type in one search phrase and the answer is number one.
Google Foo.
Yeah. Google Foo.
Yeah. You got to be good at Google Foo. All right. Enough berating our listeners. Let's get back to the phones. Our next caller is Doug from West Webster,
where
New York.
Where life is worth living.
Be very, very quiet. We're hunting West Webster. Hiya, Doug. What's up?
Happy Sabado, amigos.
Yes.
I got like 1.5 questions for you guys.
Yeah.
First of all, I live in a cookie-cutter apartment complex, and we got the Spectrum Internet up here.
Oh, boy.
Now, I got a... there's good and bad to the story. So I get this letter saying that this whole complex up here is going to be getting gigabyte internet, and they're upgrading. Now, somewhere in the letter it said, well, relax, if you have internet already, they're going to upgrade speeds, or I don't know if you have to call in to upgrade, or they're basically saying we'll be able to get the internet, the 1 gig, for $60 a month. For everybody in here,
yep.
Which to me is it's a good deal. But right now, I'm locked into some package thing. It's like, you know, they're con artists, so I'm paying $150 for cable and internet alone.
Right.
So, and then they're like, you might have to get new equipment and new stuff. What am I going to have to do, or am I going to have to change my plan, or how is that going to work, do you think, when they initiate the switchover?
Well, to be honest, that's such a can of worms, you have to talk to them.
Yeah, because 10 to 1 odds, you're right. It's going to need a faster modem.
Yeah, depending on how old your cable modem is, you may need to replace that, and they'll give you one for free that supports the DOCSIS 3.
Motorola surfboard, you know.
Do you know if it's DOCSIS 2 or DOCSIS 3? DOCSIS, DOCSIS, how do you pronounce it?
Man.
DOCSIS, yeah. So you may have to check the specs.
That's why you have to go to them. They keep all those records. The point is this. You will need a DOCSIS 3 modem capable of doing a gigabit Ethernet.
Mm-hmm. And you may also need a faster wireless router that can support those speeds as well.
And if you get your wireless through that same router, then that's done. That'll be upgraded with it.
Now, Spectrum gives you a modem, the cable modem, for free. The wireless, they charge extra for.
Right.
Well,
so
I own my own cable modem.
All right. So if it isn't DOCSIS 3 compatible, then they will give you a free DOCSIS 3 modem as part of the subscription service.
I don't know that free.
The cable modem is, yes. The wireless is not.
They charge.
And they charge differently. Some of our customers are getting $5 a month. Some are getting $10 a month.
I found out it's a Surfboard SB6121. It is a DOCSIS 3.0.
Then you're good to go with that. That shouldn't be an issue. That
speeds will take it up to 1 gigabyte. All right, and I got an Aeris Nighthawk router. Okay.
If it's AC or better, then you should be okay.
Right.
With both sides.
But as to what that does to your current charge every month.
Yeah.
We can't answer that, unfortunately. That's something you have to talk to them about.
Well, like in the letter, it basically said they're going to give people the option to either sign up for it for $60 a month, which I'm thinking drop all the TV services because I got AT&T cable, I got Hulu Plus, I got Netflix, I got Amazon Prime.
A lot of people are going to internet streaming instead of cable TV. Yeah.
Instead of paying $150, should I just get, and it makes sense, get the $60 one gigabyte. Now, here's my other kind of question, too. People are going to share the cable bandwidth, or is it
you already are.
So it's not like Greenlight. So basically they're given one gigabyte, but everybody shares it.
It depends entirely, even with Greenlight, it depends entirely on what happens in your complex.
So it's shared at some point, and they have a 1 terabyte connection somewhere that splits down to go to each individual apartment or house.
Right.
Interesting. Okay, here's my question, point five. This weekend, I got some free time. I'm going to be installing a Linux build on SSD. Gesundheit. What do you guys think about, I got two choices, Manjaro or MX Linux. Which one is better? I want a light version. Which one is better, and what do you guys think? Why?
Okay, one is Manjaro or Manjaro. What's the other one?
MX Linux.
MS MX. Linux.
MX. M is in Michael, X is in...
Oh, MX. Oh, yeah, okay. Wow. Good question. Both are pretty good. Manjaro is something that a lot of people are running. So MX Linux is kind of a mid-weight operating system. It's based on Debian, and that's good. That's all good. I'm looking to see when it was last updated.
I found a comparison chart, and Manjaro comes with Pac-Man.
Ah, well, there you go then.
Oh, that's so
as the package manager.
Now, if you guys think it's a more popular build, it will have more stuff, though.
Not necessarily, because... So here's the deal. MX Linux is a little more lightweight. So if your system that you're putting it on is a little older, maybe a little slower, MX might be a better choice.
All right.
It also uses XFCE, which is the particular GUI that it uses. That's my favorite one. I like that one. Manjaro or Manjaro, and it seems I cannot type today. Okay. Manjaro Linux is also a pretty decent, it doesn't seem to be too heavy.
It also calls it middleweight on the Linux Hint site I found.
Yeah. So really, either one would be useful. Again, as you say, it has three editions, XFCE, KDE, and GNOME, which are three different graphical user interfaces for the front end. The lovely thing with any Linux distribution is you can try any one of them. If you don't like it, load in another one.
You don't have
to wipe it out. In Linux, you just add it, and then there's a place where you can just pick the one you want.
Oh.
So you go back and forth.
Do you think it's a possibility to put both, install them both, and I could pick either one at startup? Is that a possibility?
Yeah.
It's a possibility, but it's redundant.
And that depends on how big your storage drive is, too. Yeah.
Right. It's kind of redundant. I mean, in general, the underlying operating system is going to be exactly the same.
Or here's a thought. What he could do is try putting both on. Like you said, you could switch. You know, it's redundant to put both on. And switch back and forth and see which one you really want to do. Once you find that one, you can wipe it out and then just put the clean version of that one particular one you like.
You can do that too.
Because then this way you're not taking the time to install it, play with this one, then undo it, and then put this other one on, and then, wait a minute, did this one have this feature? That you can go back and forth easily and settle on one, then do a full wipe and just put the one that you really like after you do your homework of finding out which one best fits you.
All right. I just want to say have a nice weekend, guys. I did donate 2 times during the pledge drive this year, and I really appreciate what you guys do for the community.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Take care. Nice stay Bye. Safe.
Yeah. Either one of those. They're both based on Linux, so they're both going to be the same under the hood. The real difference is which one gets updated more often. Certainly I know on Manjaro you can easily switch between GUIs.
Yeah.
So either one is going to do him just fine. And if you want to play with both of them, you'll find that it's 99.99% the same. So. Okay.
Now it's a German company. So I wonder how they pronounce. You know how Wikipedia has a pronunciation guide?
Yeah.
It helps nothing at all because nobody knows what IPA pronunciation guide is anyway.
Right.
So since it's German, it's probably Manjaro. Maybe. That J, yeah, the German J sound.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Brian from Pavilion, New York. What's up, Brian?
Gentlemen.
No. Who's that?
Oh, I called the wrong show.
Yeah, definitely.
Try again.
Actually, Raspberry Pi 4.
Yes.
I just got my first one this week. Yay, thank you.
Yep.
But I'm...
And the crowd goes wild.
Well, sort of wild. I'm too old for wild.
Yeah, welcome to that club.
My hand's shaking. How's that?
Yeah.
That's the best I can do. But anyway, actually, the first one I got in, I thought was defective because I cannot make this thing see the monitor at all.
And
of course, I've been up and down YouTube and on boards and stuff. I tried a second monitor and then my television set. The first one didn't work. So I returned it thinking it's defective.
Sure.
My replacement unit is doing exactly the same thing.
All right. Now, All right, what image did you put on the Pi?
I'm downloading it again. I use the recommended Raspberry OS from Noobs.
Okay, because all right,
is this an HDMI monitor?
It is.
Then yeah, it should. Now here's the thing though: on the Raspberry Pi, on the side there are 2 HDMI ports. Now, are you where you plug in the power, and the first one next to the power, as you're facing it, the one to the right of the power is the first HDMI plug.
It's labeled HDMI 0.
Yeah, I've already.
Of course, it is. It's not HDMI 1 and 2 because it's
binary.
Yeah, it's 0 and 1.
Binary.
So yeah, you got to put it into that.
I did.
All right, and then normally once it's booting up. What they recommend doing is you turn it on, you got to wait a few seconds because it's got to load up the operating system, hit the escape button. What that's going to do is bring up a menu. And in that menu, you got to go down to configure, and then there's the monitor. And you can go in there and you select 720.
All right.
And then... you back out of there, and then you go on down a couple more options. Because did you get the 4 or 8 gig model? Well, it doesn't really matter.
I got the 100 dollar version. I got the 8 gig.
Okay, so you're going to go on down a few more menus, and it'll sit there and say use the 3 gig model. You want to disable that because what it's doing is limiting the Raspberry Pi to 3 gig or less. If you've got the 4 or 8, you want to use it. So you just disable that, get out, save your settings, reboot. It should pop up and with a big Raspberry on the screen, and it's going to take a while for it to load. You know, it's going to take. You'll see in the bottom of the Raspberry that little square, and you'll see it circling as it's loading and building the operating system.
Right. The issue is likely that you were the resolution on your monitor is different from what the Pi is expecting. And so you have.
Because it tells me that it can't find any signal. It's not even trying to signal the monitor. I get no signal found.
Where did you get the cable you're using?
It came with it. It is an HP monitor. I had to get a HDMI adapter to the that nonsensical Dell HP plug that they use. Oh, it's an adapter. The HDMI is not a standard HDMI in my monitor. And the other one I have, too, is another HP. It just happens to have that little...
I think that's...
Are you sure it's HDMI? Because HDMI is a standard.
Yeah, it's got... You know what? HPs and Dells, some HPs and Dells have the HDMI cable has a little L-shaped thing to it. You know, instead of having the barn roof type, it's got... One side is notched.
Oh, that's for
Oh, that's not HDMI. That's DisplayPort.
Yeah, that's DisplayPort.
Right. So
I'm an idiot then.
Well, not necessarily, but you're wrong about this. You're plugging it into the wrong thing is the problem.
Yeah.
Let me. I'm an idiot. Trust me. So that's cool.
So you probably need to get a DisplayPort to HDMI adapter.
And if he's got one, because he got it plugged in.
Yeah.
Either he used a hammer or he got the adapter already. Then what you need to do is change the input on the monitor to DisplayPort.
Yeah.
But you will get a better signal if you actually plug it into HDMI.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, that solves the problem. I'm sorry I made the guys who sold me the first one go through hoops. And
No.
Been there, done that. Yeah. It makes sense.
That's the way you learn.
Sometimes it could also be the frequency. Your monitor only does 60 hertz, but the Pi is trying to do 72.
Right.
And so I
got a little more work to do here.
So what are you going to do with the Pi? Just out of curiosity.
Well, actually, I'm not sure yet. It's a solution looking for a problem right now. So, I'm just going to mess with it and see what I find. It's a little toy to mess around with.
There's a guy that does a lot of YouTube videos on, matter of fact, do a search on Twister OS under YouTube. And you'll see this one guy, it's L-E-E, I forget the full name of it, but he does a lot of YouTube videos on the Raspberry Pi, and Twister OS is a really good operating system that you can play around with and have some fun with.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I appreciate it, and... I'm a member, and I very much appreciate what you guys do.
We love that. We love hearing that you're a member. Thanks so much. All right. That music tells us you've wasted an hour of your life with this nonsense, but don't go away. There's a whole nother hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites, coming your way with Dave Enright, with Steve Ray, with Nick Francesco, and with you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll free 1-800-790-0415. Don't forget to vote in the poll, and we'll be back for another hour of Sound Bites right here on member supported Jazz 90.1. See you on the other side.
Computer talk you can understand. More Sound Bites is next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District. Jazz 90.1.
On Twitter at 901 Jazz.
Welcome back to America's longest running computer show, Soundbites, on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966 Jazz. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm still Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
What?
Yeah. We didn't change.
We are Soundbites, and it's 6 minutes after the hour. You're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. And we have Will from Hampton, Virginia on the line. Hiya, William. What's up?
Hey, guys. How are things up in Greece and Rochester? I bet it's hot.
It's beautiful up here. How are things down there? It's got to be warmer.
It's getting that part of the year that I detest because of the humidity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not the heat, it's the humidity. And you're in Hampton, so.
Yeah, I will concede that.
Yeah, so what's up?
I have a question, then a contribution.
Oh, good.
The question, okay, I have a Dell Latitude that was donated to me by a friend, and I use it as my second laptop, and it needs some major surgery. Among other things, the optical drive does not seem to be functioning. It's jammed in. I tried the conventional remedy of sticking the paper clip in that hole to no avail. So I'm thinking my next step is just simply to disassemble the drive, take it out, and then go from there.
All it is is you flip it over, there's one screw, and that's going to come sliding on out.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time, yeah, it's pretty easy to get out.
Yeah, you just slide it out, and if you go and get, say, a replacement one on eBay, all you're going to have to do is it'll probably come, but it won't come with it. So don't throw that one out. Hang on to it, because there's a little, that where you're undoing that screw, that's a little bracket that screws onto the back of the drive. So what you're going to have to do is when they send you this new drive, because all, you know, they usually use the universal drives anyways. So what you're going to wind up doing is taking this new drive, taking the adapter off the old one and installing a new one so you can slide it in, screw it in, you're up and running.
Okay, that's good information, because I was afraid that it would be something of a proprietor.
No,
they're all using standard parts these days.
And it may be that once you get the disc out of it, it may work fine. It just may be a stuck disc. Somebody may try to put two discs in.
I was just about to
we had a customer bring the machine in, and their small child had managed to get three discs in. And, you know, I've seen two, and you have to push really hard to get two in that drive, but getting a third one in the slot, too?
That's hard.
Yeah, but usually it'll say, when you flip it over, you'll see a little, like, icon or that next to the screw hole that holds the CD-ROM drive in.
Okay.
And like I say, you undo that one, or just, again, watch YouTube, and it'll tell you how to take it out.
And before you go buying a replacement, as Steve said, take that old one out and see if there's something stuck in it.
Yeah, because once you get it apart, you're going to be able to see it all, and you know you can usually free it up and that.
Yeah, okay then. That's good. Okay, now for my contribution.
There you go.
I have been baffled for the longest time, for time immemorial, about why in the world would SATA beat faster than PETA. So I finally Googled it, and this is what I came up with. When PETA is transmitting, it has to inspect, apparently it has to inspect each bit of the word before it transmits.
Yep.
And that would, in effect, slow down the transmission time and create some latency. And so you just don't have the same issue with SATA.
Yeah.
Right, and that's true between parallel and serial interfaces of all sorts. You would think parallel would be faster.
Yeah, if you have more lines in parallel,
Right, eight bits rather than one.
An eight-lane road is faster than a two-lane road.
Right, yeah.
That's what you would think. But
No. And it's never been true because of that testing that has to be done.
Nice.
Anyway.
There you go. Thanks. You. That's good information. Thank you.
Of course. And thank you, fellas, for your advice.
All right. Stay cool. Stay dry.
Down in the humid areas.
There's all kinds of depending on the it doesn't happen anymore. But it used to be you could change all kinds of things in a laptop. You could add RAM or change the RAM. You could change the hard drive. You could I used to have a Dell Latitude, and this may be the same model, that you could replace the optical drive with another hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have multiple hard drives in it.
There was a Mac model once where you could put a hard drive in the battery bay.
Right.
And there were two battery bays, so you could have two batteries or you could have two hard drives.
Right. There was a Dell model that was the same. Yeah.
But nowadays, everything is getting to be built into the motherboard. You know, it's one part, which makes it easy to manufacture, makes it easy to repair, makes it expensive to repair, but it makes it easy because if something's wrong, it's that one board.
That's all it is. You pop it out, you put the new one in, you're done.
Yeah.
And so it's easier for them, and in fact, in the long run, cheaper for them.
Yep.
Because they pay fewer technicians.
Yeah.
Which means there's, you know, all kinds of money in the background.
Easier to assemble. It can be assembled by a robot instead of people.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Dan from Brighton, New York. Hi, Dan. What's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. So I'm an old-timer, and so are you guys. And maybe your audience wants to know why they call a bug a bug.
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
Well, back in the day when they had vacuum tubes in the computers, there actually was a moth that got into one of the vacuum tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, if there's a problem with a computer, they call it a bug.
But yep.
Yep.
And that bug has been immortalized.
Immortalized.
You know, Grace Hopper put it in the logbook, and now that it's on her Wikipedia entry, it's probably under computer bug, too.
And she actually wrote, debugged the computer.
Yeah.
That's where that phrase came from.
Is it in the Smithsonian?
It's certainly in one of those museums, whether it's a computer museum or the Smithsonian or wherever it is. Steve's looking it up now.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot. We appreciate that. Thanks.
Did you have a question?
No, that's it.
That's right, it. That's good.
You
thanks.
Have a great day.
We're on. Where Steve just keeps adding more stuff. I don't know how the heck he does it. But we're not only live on the air and live on the video stream, thanks to Jazz 90.1. And of course, you can listen to the podcasts on our website or through the Jazz 90.1 app. But Steve is also streaming on YouTube and now also streaming on Facebook. We've got a number of people who are watching us. Glad you found us. We've been around for 30 plus years, so pretty much nonstop. So we're pretty happy that people have found us. So you can find us, of course, at Soundbites Radio on Facebook or at Soundbites Radio. I think it is also on YouTube. And
Soundbites Org on YouTube.
Soundbites Org on YouTube, yeah. And you can listen, you can stream us live. Of course, like I said, stream us live over the air through the app or whatever. But we're here. We're here in a lot of different ways. Rob wants to take that picture off. I have other pictures, Rob. This is the one you would object to least, so remain calm is all I have to say. Back to the phones.
Well, say Admiral Hopper's bug. Well,
we could put that Teletubby one up of him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Grace Hopper's bug, she retired an admiral, is in the Smithsonian Museum of American History in Washington, D.C.
There you go. All right, to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Brighton, New York. Hiya, Tom. What's up?
Yeah, just my question is really along the lines of a business question, actually. You know, I started out, like most people do, with a Frontier line that went to my house, and I at one point connected to the networks through the copper wire of the telephone line. Then I went to cable, coaxial cable, and now I'm on green light, so I've got fiber optic. Meanwhile, I've got the other two lines still connected, and of course, the companies that support them have to provide support for that, too, at maintenance, to keep those lines up on the poles, and whenever they're brought down, they have to put them back up again. That costs money. So there ought to be a competitive pressure at this point to bring the cost of cable and Frontier's, you know, copper telephone lines down in price somewhat, to at least attempt to compete with Greenlight. And it seems not to have happened. I'm just wondering why.
It's mostly a technological limitation that the telephone wires can't handle that much data.
Yeah.
Most DSL internet is limited to 5 or 6 megabit if you're lucky. And many of the times, because I know the phone companies will offer faster internet, you know, they'll give you 12 megabit or 24 megabit internet, and that's by running multiple phone lines and flexing them together. And because of that older infrastructure, the original phone system only used two wires. And it just couldn't handle the throughput that we started wanting.
Right, but of course the cable has a somewhat higher bandwidth. They could
up to about 300 megabits, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they have the right of way. What's to stop those companies, Frontier and the Spectrum Company, or whoever replaced them, to add fiber optic lines?
Nothing.
It's just whether they can, again, like you said, come up with the money as you know, the phone service is a dying art. I mean, most folks nowadays have done away with their home phone, and everybody's using their own cell phone.
Here's the thing about fiber optic stuff. You have to start all the way back at the back end, because it's not just running the cable, it's also all new connectors and all new boxes in between, and those cost a lot of money.
But these are big companies. These are multi-billion.
Yes, but they don't want to spend money. They want to make money.
Yeah,
trying to convince a company to spend $1 billion because they're going to make $10 billion. Well, we don't want to spend $1 billion, but you're going to make
$10 billion doesn't come in this year, and I got to get my bonus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This quarter.
Yeah.
Then inevitably they're going to be lose their business 100%. It'll be displaced by companies like Greenlight.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way it's becoming because, like I said, look at most folks. They've done away with the home phones. It's usually just a business.
Yeah.
They have phone lines coming into their company. And even that, they still need separate internet service because they need that T1 line or whatever to do all their corporate stuff.
And a lot of businesses have been moving to voice over IP because you get so many more features. We just switched to a new service that lets us use our cell phones as our business line. So we have company cell phones. And someone dials our company phone number and all of our cell phones ring.
Nice.
And apparently it was written by the guys that did Google Voice before they left Google.
Might make sense to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's lots of problems with the old
underlying
way of doing
cost.
Things. But many of the people who are running and I'm not just talking about the local companies. I'm talking about all over the world. Many of the people running those companies are old people. And I can say that because I am one. And they can't get their minds set around the new business models.
Well, they've got shareholders who want to be putting the pressure on them.
Well, yes, they do.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I've got these two lines, the telephone and the cable lines. The only purpose they serve now is as a perch for birds to drop their business
on
cars.
Yep.
Okay, guys. Thanks very much.
Have fun. Yeah, I've got lines coming into my house that I'll never use anymore.
Yeah, and who knows what's going to replace fiber? That's even better.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Somebody's your name.
But yeah, so there's so many good alternatives, and there are so many probable future technologies that should come along shortly. But one of the advantages that the fiber companies have today is that, particularly if they're a new fiber company, they don't have old stuff that they're trying to maintain while they're doing the new stuff. All they have is the new thing, and that makes it more cost-effective for them to build out because they don't have to worry about maintaining old stuff while they're doing new stuff. Can you imagine if a phone company, any phone company in the country, said, you know what, we're going to put in all fiber now, but for the next 6 months, you're not going to have phone service, but stick around for us.
Yeah. Ain't going to happen.
And the phone companies have been putting fiber in, trying to compete in the high-speed business market, but they're almost ignoring residential. I remember a couple of years ago at our office, we were looking for better phone service, and we went to the phone company, and they said they could give us an ISDN line.
Yeah, but they're...
And that was twice as expensive and half the speed of what the cable company was offering.
Right. But right now, they're too late to the coming to the party.
Yeah.
Right. The party's almost over with as far as that goes.
Right. It's exactly right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tony from Pittsford, New York. What's up, Tony?
Hi. I've got an old XPS 8700 tower, and my hard drive in it failed, and I took it in and had it replaced with an SSD, and this strange thing happened when it comes back, and that is if I power down my computer, it doesn't go completely off. Back in the old days when you'd shut it off, you'd see the system go down, and if you kind of peeked into the computer, there was a yellow light inside, and it would slowly go down as the capacitors inside discharged, and if you pulled the plug and pushed the plug back in, nothing would happen. Now, when I shut the thing down, that yellow light stays on. I've left the computer on overnight, and it's still there.
Yeah, it's trying to be helpful and waiting for you to turn it back on again.
Yeah, well, and then I unplug the power, and it finally goes off. And as soon as I plug the power back in, the yellow light comes on. Is that didn't used to happen? Is that a switch in the power supply that they didn't set back, or does an SSD require power to stay on?
No, it's probably a capacitor. A capacitor is holding that charge in the computer, and with the SSD, it takes less power to run it. So that's why that capacitor is probably, it's still sending power to it, to even keep that little bulb lit.
And very few computers have a physical power switch anymore. It's all electronic switches.
Yeah, electronic switching.
And even when you turn it off, it doesn't power down completely because it's waiting for you to turn it back on again. And it's created something called vampire energy. All the power bricks that your devices have are on and hot, even when the device is off, because it's converting your power, waiting for you to use. So there's been a big push in the electric communities to reduce the amount of power that devices use when they're not plugged in, or even when they are plugged in but not turned on, because of all the wasted energy.
Okay. Well, so there's no way to get it to go off other than to switch off the...
I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, it's a tiny trickle of power, and the idea is that it's something that used to at least be called instant on.
Yeah.
So when you hit the button, in a sense, it's a very good thing, because one of the problems that computers have is something called thermal shock. When they're cold, and you just jam a bunch of electricity into them, that thermal shock can kill it.
Well, that's why we used to advocate, which I still to this day leave my computer on all the time. Because back in the day, that sudden turning on and then shutting it off, turning it back on, some folks would sit there and turn on and off their computers 7-8 times during the day.
Turn on, check your mail, turn it off.
And so by leaving that trickle of electricity on, it means that you don't get that sudden shock of electricity, and the motherboard and all the other components will last longer.
It's an interesting catch-22 that if you leave it on all the time, it's always hot and always running and always wearing out. If you turn it on and off a lot, it goes through these thermal cycles and wears out. But typically the thermal cycles will kill it faster than left on.
Have you ever had a light bulb that didn't die when you turned it on? 99.9% of the time, they die when you turn them on. And the reason is thermal shock. If you leave a light bulb on all the time, it'll last you decades.
Well, yeah, what's that? There's a light bulb in a San Francisco firehouse that's been on for 120 years.
Yeah.
Because they've never turned it off.
They've never turned it off, and it just keeps running. So that's the idea. What?
Can I ask a second question?
Sure.
I used to have two hard drives in my computer, a main one and an old one that I'd taken out of another computer and installed. When they reworked my computer and put the SSD in, for some reason they rewired it so that I really can't plug in the second drive without moving things around. And when I went into I'm going to say things that I mess with but don't quite understand, the UEFI firmware, and look, it looks like there's nothing in the list of things that includes the ability for another drive, and you can't modify the SATA readings that are in there. Do you have to use something called APTIO software or something to go in and modify that?
No. When you hook up a second drive, it will automatically find that drive.
And it won't find it until it's plugged in. Right. So the UEFI firmware can't find a drive that's not there.
Right. And most of the time, the reason to use a second drive because the first one was too small. Now that drives are so big, the frequency of needing a second drive has gotten pretty low.
Well, there are other reasons for a second drive, too. But
you can do it anyway, yeah.
Yeah. So if I just power down and figure out how to get the thing plugged in, given the way they bolted it back together.
Right.
What
probably happened is he had a 3.5-inch hard drive, and all of the SSDs are 2.5-inch form factor. So they had to figure out how to mount that in the 3.5-inch bay.
And put it in an adapter.
Well, they probably didn't.
They just took the bay apart and drilled some holes and attached it to the plate. Yeah.
Or you spend $20 for an adapter that lets you put a 2.5-inch drive in a 3.5-inch bay.
But if I can get it plugged in there, it will detect it automatically.
Yep. It should find it automatically, yes.
Now, here's the thing, though. What might have been also, you, depending on your power supply and everything else, you're going to, when you put this other drive back in, it's probably going to have to go to a bay down below where your other one is in this tall tower. Now, sometimes you might have to get power extenders. In other words, they're like extension cords.
Okay.
To get your power in that, because usually the cable, the what we call the SATA cable, going to the motherboard, to the drive, usually those are long enough. But quite often, because the power supply is up so high, it won't always reach to the bottom of the case. So you might have to, online, you can get power extender, extension cords.
Okay. I wondered if such a thing was made.
Yep.
Like, you go to Amazon or somebody?
Yep.
You got it.
You can just get a long, if your SATA cord's too short, you can get a longer SATA cord. And if the power cord's too short, you can get an extension power cord.
Like you say,
the power cords are usually called the old ones are Molex.
Yeah.
So there's SATA data and SATA power.
Right.
And ironically,
if you look for SATA data and SATA power, you'll find it.
The data cable is 7 pins, and the power cable is 10, is it?
I think it's
weird the power cable has more pins than the data cable.
Yep. Yeah, no, I know which is which. Okay, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the help.
Thank you, Tony. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites. Don't forget to vote in the poll. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And, I want to read this one. And the heck with everybody else.
Okay.
You're running the show.
I'm running the show. I'm going to do what I want.
You can do whatever you want.
I will make you the big pitcher.
Yeah.
For that.
Go ahead and do it now. Google is rolling out new safety features for Chrome, which are designed to make it easier to spot dubious downloads and extensions. They build upon the browser's enhanced safe browsing feature, which launched last year to offer better warnings against phishing sites. When it comes to Chrome extensions, the browser will now show a warning if what you're installing is not considered trusted. In order to be trusted, extensions need to come from a developer that has followed Google's developer program policies and has been around for at least a few months. That means brand new developers won't immediately be considered trusted by Google. When attempting to download an extension that's not trusted, Chrome will show a pop-up warning that you should proceed with caution, which, of course, you will ignore and then be angry later.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's still the option to continue to install. So Google says nearly 3/4 of the extensions on Chrome Store will be considered trusted under its criteria. Not being trusted doesn't mean Google thinks an extension is dangerous, but its developer might simply be newer to the store or have never recently committed some minor policy violation. Chrome is also getting a new scanning feature for suspicious-looking downloads. In the future, any downloads that seem risky but not clearly unsafe will offer an option to upload them to Google services for a more thorough scan. This process can be bypassed if you prefer, which you should never do, but it offers an extra layer of protection when downloading files from the web. The new scanning option is offered in addition to the existing metadata checks that Chrome already performs on downloads. Mm-hmm. Google says the new features are rolling out gradually for Chrome 91, the version of the browser that released late last month. So are you ready for an even more secure Chrome OS? Give us a call, 585 866 Jazz. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. This will be good on every operating system, but it will also be extra good on Chrome OS. And the reason is, while Chrome itself, we've talked about this many times, can't get a virus, yada, 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 there is an issue with the ability to install bad extensions. Mm-hmm. So I had a guy who was angry one week because his, we told him Chrome OS is great, and then he gets this thing that changed his, all of a sudden his browser changed and everything changed, and he was going to a different, he wasn't going to Google anymore, he was going somewhere else. And it turned out he'd installed an extension.
Yep.
It was a toolbar.
And a browser hijack.
Right. Is a toolbar that did all kinds of things. Once we removed it, everything was back to normal. Well, now the Chrome browser itself will be checking these things, so it is less likely you will be able to do that without at least ignoring a warning message.
And it's a shame we have to do this, because it's going to slow down web browsing a tiny fraction, but yep. Multiplied by all the millions of links you go to, sometimes without it realizing it, you open one website, there might be 100 links on it,
exactly.
The bad guys have just spoiled everything for us.
Yep.
Well, plus when you go download a program, they've a lot of packages now, you go to install this one package, but tied into it are all right. These other add-ons.
Dependencies.
Yeah. And people think, oh, I got to say yes to this. And now all of a sudden, all these other programs, toolbars, and everything else has been installed.
That's exactly right.
You can say no to those. Decline.
There was just an interesting episode of Security Now where they were talking about dependency hijacking, where a company writes a program and excuse me, quite often they will use public libraries.
Right.
And so I want this Ethernet library and this, TCP library. And so their code goes out to the public internet, to GitHub or one of the other repositories, and looks for the latest version of that library. And then they also have their own private internal libraries that they use themselves. Well, a researcher figured out, fortunately he was a good guy, but we don't know if the bad guys knew this first. If he makes a library with the same name as somebody's private library, and he got Google and Apple and Microsoft and Facebook and all of the big name companies, if he makes a library with that same name, most of the time the code will look at the public repository first.
Right.
Or if not, it will take the one that has the highest version number, public or private. And so the bad guy just makes his version number 9,000.
Right.
And his malicious code gets picked all the time when companies are building their software. And he has received several $100,000 in bounties from all of these companies that he pointed this out to. But it hasn't stopped the problem. And the private library names can't be kept private. And that's what they were basically relying on, is this is a private name. Nobody's ever going to use this. And they said, well, I found about 200 private names just casually looking and was able to hijack a bunch of dependencies.
Yep.
And that's how our software is built.
Exactly. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Pat from Batavia, New York. Hiya, Pat. What's up?
Well, first of all, let me just say, I think the quote of the day from Steve is, the bad guys have ruined things for everyone.
It's true.
Yeah. I mean, it's just laws are made because stupid people do stupid things, and they say, oh, we got to keep it from doing stupid things, so we'll make laws that restrict everybody else.
Right.
Yep.
But that is not my call today. My call is, I had a sound card that was working very nicely, and at some point it just stopped. And, it's an eighth-inch plug, and I had a hard time finding a USB speaker with a USB, so I did. And now it's playing, but I keep wondering about that sound card. So I'm looking online, and most of the information seems to push you towards the idea that it's a bad driver rather than a bad sound card. Is there an easy way to tell the difference between, that is a hardware problem versus software?
Easy, no.
Okay.
Sort of. Uninstall the driver and install a clean driver.
Well,
if that works, then it was software. If it doesn't work, it's hardware.
Right.
Well, I was going to say, usually, if you... No, I take it this is Windows.
Yeah, right, Windows 10.
If you go into the device manager and look under devices.
Okay, I've done a lot of that, so if you can talk along, I'll
yeah, now has, when you go down to that sound card, does it say that it's installed there correctly?
Yeah, there's, I think I saw something where there's like some yellow question mark or something if there's a problem with it. Mine looks fine.
See, and that makes sense to me because you're still mm-hmm. getting sound. Yeah. Just because you plugged the sound into a USB port, the yeah. sound still has to go through the sound card. So what it sounds to me like, no pun intended, is either you've got bad speakers, a bad cable.
The speakers are, no, I did. I went through the diagnostics, moved the speakers first. That's the first thing I did. Took the speakers to another system. Speakers are good. So, yeah.
Or a bad connector. Don't forget, those connectors are cheap. And
now
they are just...
connector on the computer.
The connector in the sound card, the 8-inch plug connector in the sound card.
Yeah, okay. So
if that's gone bad, you know, if you can wiggle it a little, it may not be working anymore.
Right. And when you play any of the internal, well, he's still plugged through there.
Yeah. If you're hearing sound, the sound card is working because computers don't have sound without a sound card somewhere.
So whether it's the USB or the 8-inch plug, if there's sound, it's coming from a sound card.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's no other place.
Well, okay, that part I don't understand. It's
well, some logic boards have a sound card on the logic board.
And but then, if he looks in the device manager and there's not a problem with the sound card, then the system is clearly using the sound card.
Yeah.
Well, and here's one more little interesting wrinkle because, you know, those problems never end. I looked under the settings and sound output. And next to the internal auxiliary jack, in parentheses it says Droid Cam Virtual Audio. Now, at some point, because you can do this, and I have no idea why, I try to figure out how I could use my cell phone as an auxiliary camera, or as an extra camera. And it also hooked up the sound there, too. So I'm wondering, could that have messed it up?
It could have changed the output to that device, yes. And now you'd have to figure out how to change it back.
Okay, and the way I guess I could find out is if I actually go back and remember how to use the device, and then if it plays through the device, then I know I got to work with getting it back to just straight output. But the other thing is,
sometimes if you just take the device and delete it, and have Windows refined it, fresh, it'll set it back to the basic settings.
Well,
That was the thing I thought, well, this is easy, but quite often I've made many mistakes and put myself into many jams when I said, oh, this looks easy. And then,
yeah, it's easy to do. It's hard to undo. Theoretically, you probably had to install software because there's a separate Droid Cam virtual audio driver.
Right.
So theoretically, you had to install that to get that to work.
Yep.
If you uninstall that driver, it should go back to using the 8-inch jack.
Okay. I will play around with that. And one last thing with what Dave mentioned about the or whoever mentioned it. The sound was crackling a little bit before it went bad. Would that be like an indication that the jack?
Yep.
Yep.
Is okay. So in that case, all this other stuff is for naught because if the connector on the computer is not good, then so what do you do then? You have to buy a new card or?
Well, what you did was put in a USB.
No, I meant if I wanted to go because I do like there's so many more offerings with the 8-inch plug versus the
right
a USB.
Well, you can certainly uninstall that Droid Cam driver.
That'll be my first time.
And see if it works. Yeah. If it does, you're done. If not, you're pretty much going to be stuck with...
No. This is a desktop unit?
Yes, sir. Desktop.
Yeah, just get another sound card. They're dirt cheap.
Yeah. Okay, well, you've given me a lot of stuff. What I love about your show is you guys are so much smarter and so much quicker than me. And so if I don't remember, I just go back and listen again.
That's what we like to hear.
There you go.
Use those archives.
Yeah. Listen to you over and over and over again. And I'm a little disappointed that Steve didn't put Nick in the big picture there. when he
I tried and then Nick covered his camera.
That's exactly right.
I figured it was something. I said, I see Steve hard at work there and it's not working, so somebody did something. So
yep, exactly.
And thanks so much for being here all the time. We appreciate you, even though we don't always get a chance to call in or always get a chance to say so.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Have fun. Yeah. So if you're on, oh, that's interesting. Okay. If you're on Facebook, you can go to our channel, Soundbites Radio. I'm not on Facebook.
Facebook is, I forgot. Soundbites Radio. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can get on and see us live. If you're on YouTube, same thing, Soundbites.org.
Soundbites.org. Yep.
And, if you're on, some drugs, you probably see us anyway.
Go to jazz901.org and listen to the audio stream
listen
there.
Listen to the audio stream there. So it's all kinds of places you can find us. Back to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Rochester, New York. What's up, Tom?
Hi, just a quick question. Months ago, I, based on your advice, I uninstalled the Adobe Flash Player.
Oh, yeah.
And now there's a website that I go to on occasion. It's a webcam from up in the Adirondacks. And when I click on the individual pictures, the pictures don't come out anymore. Could that be any connection?
Yeah. Well, it's one of two things. Either they're still using Flash, for which shame on them, because...
Flash was deprecated 10 years ago and officially discontinued, and Adobe removed it from use last year.
Yeah.
Well, I contacted them asking them, you know, what format they use, and I never got a reply.
Yeah. Or they've just turned off the webcams.
I see. Okay.
And, I mean, it's there's really... Okay. What browser do you use?
Firefox.
Yeah, you might try Chrome. Chrome has a built-in Adobe Flash-like player.
Like-ish.
And that one might work. So, for example, you might see something that says, you get a little red bar that says, click here to start your audio or something, yeah. Or video, says something like that. And that may work, but no promises because... like Steve said, it's a decade ago they stopped making
it's
Flash.
Dead. Don't bring it back to life.
It's going to stay dead.
It had so many bugs that Adobe was releasing updates, seemed like every week. And so the bad guys started making fake Adobe Flash updates because you were so used to installing them, you just did.
Yes, yeah. And there's no other substitute I could use to...
Well, it depends on... It's all on their end, you know, right? So if they're still sending out Flash, maybe Chrome will work.
Okay.
If they've turned off the cameras, you're done. But it's up to them to decide to go to HTML5 or whatever else is available.
Which came out 6 years ago.
Yeah. But they have to do that. You can't do anything about it.
Okay. All righty. Thank you for your information.
Yep. Thanks, Tom.
Bye.
Yeah, I still find places that you go to them and there's the square with the sad face in it.
Yeah.
Really? You've got Flash elements?
When the front page was a Flash element and that's all you could see.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that there was never a point at which Google could index a Flash page.
Yep.
So if your whole front page was Flash, you were ignored by Google. Done. No one could find you. And that's always been a problem.
And in the days of dial-up modems, which was common for Flash, it took forever to download that giant front page, and people probably wouldn't wait and would skip on.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, Flash is long gone and unmourned.
Archaic.
Yeah, it is unmourned. So if you were using Flash, I'm sorry for you, but it is done. And I know a number of people who learned how to, you know, do stuff in Flash.
Yeah.
Some of them wrote code directly and whatever, and it's, you know, God love them.
Even Adobe was publishing alternatives to Flash, and you could use Adobe's other technologies.
Right.
In fact, when you uninstall Flash, you get a message saying, you know, we're glad to have been part of the development of the internet over the last 20 years, and here's some of our other software you might want.
Yeah, exactly. So, and a lot of people are using HTML5 now, which does all kinds of, you can even do Blink if you need to do it. And if you do, I'll come and find you. But but you can do, you know, whatever it takes, without Flash. And there are just a lot of places that, because Flash was easy with webcams, there were a couple of packages you could buy or just download that let you do webcams over Flash on your web page. And if people didn't want to upgrade or didn't have it, you know, if they're just a couple of webcams on a campsite somewhere in the Adirondacks and they don't have anybody who can replace that software, then they just do without. That's all there is to it. There's no way around that.
Yeah, it was something they were doing for free anyways, and if they don't want to spend the extra money to upgrade it or do that because it's not, you know, deriving them any money out of it,
right?
What's the incentive? Just
right.
Unplug it and be done with it.
Yeah, there's also, is it EarthCams? EarthCams.com, I think it is. Yeah, EarthCam.com.
EarthCam, yeah. Blue Mountain Lake in the Adirondacks.
Yeah, you can see, you can find all kinds of places. See, there you go. This page took a virtual vacation. Okay.
Well, yeah, you can see like eagles and peregrine falcons and all that nesting. And
well, I found a website called Pure Eagles Adirondacks that has a dozen different webcams listed.
Yeah, I'm looking at a live one of Duck Creek Village in Utah.
Oh, you can see.
Well, I think I am. Nothing's happening. It's you're just looking at the side of a mountain, okay? Unless a goat falls off it, you're not going to see anything changing anyway.
Well, they used to have a webcam for the Mr. and Mrs. President Eagle because there was an eagle's nest not far from the White House.
Yep.
And they had that for the longest time up, and the eagles, you could see them nesting the whole winter because that's normally when they lay their eggs is in January.
We had them in the Kodak Tower.
Yeah, what was
peregrine falcons?
Was it falcons in at Kodak?
There's falcon. This EarthCam.com. There's bird nesting season. There's ospreys and falcons, and
that's what. Believe it or not, when I worked at Home Depot, I tried to get them to build a peregrine falcon box. It's a very simple design that, you know, it's only got to be like 3 feet long, foot and a half deep, and a foot and a half high. Yeah. And then you have a little bar out front. The advantage, why I wanted this falcon, because we did have one, and he stuck around for a couple of weeks. And that was one amazing thing, because we had two issues, pigeons and mice.
Oh, yeah.
And this falcon was having a field day. I thought, well, why not encourage him to build a box right on top of the back part of the building and let him nest there?
Right.
You've got a free rodent control animal. Because here they were spending all this money on nets and this electronic to keep the pigeons away, because they get even. We had a pigeon in the store that was so smart over there by garden.
How smart was he?
He could walk up to the door and trigger that little beam.
Yep.
He knew where to land. Literally moved a little bit. You'd see the door open. He'd fly on in and go to the left, because that's where the bird seed was. I mean, they can sit there and say they're dumb animals, but they learn quick.
Yeah, yeah, they do. They're not that dumb.
It was fun to watch, because this bird would literally come down, sit down. You'd see him waddle around just a little bit. He'd catch the beam, then boom, door would open. He'd go flying on in.
Have you seen the videos where people make squirrel obstacle courses in their backyard?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And how quick the squirrels figure out the obstacles to get to the nuts? It's just amazing.
Well, I've got a bird feeder. I wanted to get this other one, but my late wife, Lori, wouldn't let me. They over at the birdhouse, they had these bird feeders. And I got the one, it has like four little arms on it. So that if a squirrel goes over and grabs it and tries to get on that little arm, it bends down, he falls off.
Yeah.
All right, but there's a better one. This one had a long tube and it had a round ring on it. Now, birds could land on it, no problem. Squirrel grabs it and it kicks in the motor, and all of a sudden this squirrel is going around.
And it flings them off.
And throws them off into the garden. When I first saw this video, I was standing in the middle of the store with this friend of mine, because we were shopping with our wives, and laughing our butts off. We had him replay the video because it was so much fun watching the squirrel grab a hold of it. He's going, woo, 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 boom.
Yep.
Throws them off.
She
didn't want to get that one.
My father-in-law had an issue with squirrels and tried everything. We eventually had to discourage him from getting a little 410 shotgun.
My dad got a BB gun for the rabbits in our garden. And he could shoot them and they didn't care.
Right.
So then he started shooting the metal poles, which went twang, and it ran away.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was much younger, there was a guy who had a gopher problem, and we used to go out there and in his farm, and he said it was legal, and I was 16, so I didn't know, and pot shot him.
Yeah, you know?
and then he would feed them to his dogs.
Yeah,
I'm sure not just hand them to the dog. I'm sure he butchered them first.
Yeah. But still, it's rodent control, and for their crops and everything else, they've got a right to do that.
Yeah, it was, and they weren't as cute as they could have been, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that music tells us that this particular episode is done. I want to thank Dave Enright, Steve Ray. I'm Nick Francesco. It's 59 minutes after the hour, and you have been listening to 2 solid hours of the longest-running computer show in the known universe, Soundbites. I want to thank each and every one of you who called in. We had a number of very good questions today, so you should all be proud of yourselves, especially those of you who are also members of the station, because Jazz 90.1 is a solely member-supported station, and we appreciate and love each and every one of our supporters, and particularly those of you who joined around the Soundbites family. But we're done for another week. We'll see you in just 166 hours. Be good to one another, will you?